Hello, this is The New World, a podcast produced by Reaction, exploring the world after the coronavirus crisis. I'm Jack Dickens, International Editor at Reaction. The Middle East is in crisis. The hopeful Arab Spring has left a complex legacy, and Western interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan have unraveled in the face of insurgency and state collapse. So, what will the impact of the coronavirus pandemic be on the region now? And is there still hope for a better future in the Middle East? With me to discuss these issues today are Emma Skye, Senior Fellow at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs, and a former Senior Political Advisor to the US military leadership in Iraq, and Robert Fox, Veteran War Correspondent and Defense Editor at the Evening Standard. So Emma, why has stable democracy proven to be so elusive in the Middle East?
Well, I think there are a number of factors. When we look at how democracy grew up in the West, we kind of think back to the Magna Carta, which established that those who are forced to pay taxes should have some say in deciding what they're used for. And this was taken up sort of six centuries later in the American colonies, when they were demanding no taxation without representation. But when you look at the Middle East, over half the countries in the region are rentier states, which means that they depend on their income from the rent of oil rather than taxes paid for by the productive labor of their citizens. And so you don't have that same sense of public accountability. And then they've used the oil rents to invest in building up security apparatuses to maintain themselves in power and to crush dissent. And this kind of established a regional norm in which elections were rigged and security forces were used to crush opposition. And, across the Arab world, the middle classes were prepared to accept this kind of status quo and collude with the regimes because they feared that the only alternative to the autocratic rulers was Islamist rule. And they didn't want that. And I think the final factor has been the policies of external powers. There was always this relationship about, we'll buy your oil and we'll sell you weapons. And I think those factors have really prevented stable democracy from emerging in the region.
Do you have anything to add there, Robert?
Two things. One is the evolution of the region. And there are things that are taken for granted in a Western European, North American concept of political economy. And that is what the Renaissance delivered with the cult of the individual. And the other is the Industrial Revolution. So you have nothing like the growth of the buy-in of an entrepreneurial and working industrial class that you had across the industrialized or industrializing world. I'm absolutely in agreement with Emma as to where we are now. And it's part of these sort of unspoken deals is that the state has to offer some kind of security guarantee. And that is the thing, as we speak now in 2020, it is coming under question and is breaking down so badly. When you get a rump security state like the Assad regime from Damascus, even that isn't working. And the rentier approach, one of the extreme examples is Algeria, where they've lifted off hydrocarbon, gas and oil revenues, not even bothered with taxes, and it's kept le pouvoir, as they call it, the governing oligarchy in power. Even that is breaking down. One of the things we'll be discussing is the changing dynamic with hydrocarbon rewards. And the world, the Western world, is becoming less and less dependent on these fuels. Not that they will dispense with them altogether, but the ones that come from the Gulf and the wider Middle East region.
So these problems in the region and in nearby North Africa clearly go way back into history. I'd like to narrow the window now slightly, if I may. You two have both spent a lot of time on the ground in war zones in the Middle East. And I would like to ask, from your experiences, why have Western interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan proven to be so destabilizing?
Well, with the big military of the United States supported by coalition partners, it's been very easy to overthrow regimes. But the real challenge has been to build up a capable and legitimate state. And in 2003, after the invasion of Iraq, the US decided it was going to create this new Iraq and put it on new foundations. So it dismissed the Ba'ath Party and it dismissed all the security forces. And it set up a governing council to advise it. And this was 25-member body. And the posts in it were allocated based on sect and ethnicity. And this approach was supposed to ensure pluralism. But what it did was really increase the divides within society. It didn't strengthen what people actually have in common. It made sect and ethnicity the primary organizing principle for the first time in Iraq's history. And this quotas by sect and ethnicity went on to permeate down through the institutions. So it was these US policies that led to state collapse and sectarian civil war. And in amongst the chaos, groups such as Al-Qaeda in Iraq and then its successor, the Islamic State, were able to flourish. And when you look at the situation in Iraq today, the security situation has improved, but the governance system is still that same one, whereby ministries are allocated to political parties which are based on sect and ethnicity, and they divvy up the oil wealth between them. And so you have this kleptocratic political class, which lives in comfort in the green zone in Baghdad, and it's detached from the population, which receives very poor public services, and people don't have jobs, and there's this big alienation.
Was there a way in which another outcome could have been possible, and what do you think it would have taken in Iraq?
I think at various stages, there were possibilities for different outcomes. You know, you could argue that we should never have invaded in the first place because it was based on the assumption that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, which was found out that he didn't have. But nothing that happened after 2003 was inevitable. There were different pathways and there were different possible outcomes for Iraq. So you can imagine a different scenario of not collapsing the state, but dismissing the guys at the very, very top of it who had been involved in war crimes and mass murder of the Iraqi people, but maintaining the civil service beneath it and working with what was there. And I think if the state hadn't been collapsed, then the civil war, that bloodshed, could have been avoided. And then when you look at the period between 2007, 2008, that period that, you know, we call the surge or the awakening, during that period, Iraq stabilized and all the different groups were brought into the political process. But a big mistake was made in 2010 when Iraq had a very closely contested election. And during that election, a new group came together called Iraqeer that campaigned on a platform of no to sectarianism, Iraq for all Iraqis. And it went on to win the most seats in the election. And yet the international community failed to uphold those election results. And the US put its weight behind the incumbent, Nouri al-Maliki. Maliki managed to stay in power with the support of the Iranians and the Americans. And then he implemented a series of sectarian policies, going after his political rivals, accusing them of terrorism, reneging on his promises to the Sunni awakening that had fought against al-Qaeda, and basically creating the conditions which enabled the Islamic State to rise up out of the ashes of al-Qaeda and proclaim itself as the defender of the Sunnis against the Iranian-backed sectarian regime of Nouri al-Maliki. You know, and that led to ISIS being able to take over a third of the country. So none of that needed to have happened. So at various stages, Iraq has been at crossroads and has gone down particular paths.
And Robert, I want to ask you, is there another problem in all of this? I know you're particularly concerned about a lack of good reporting from the ground in the Middle East. Is this related to some of the perhaps simplistic thinking that we have surrounding the region, you know, not in, only in terms of the public in our countries, but also our policymakers?
Nothing so ill becomes a reporter to go after the media. It's too easy a target, and it's not true either. There are some very good reporters, excellent reporting, very brave, and people have given their lives doing it for a thing which is a pursuit and a passion. And at the bottom of it, without being too grand about it, we're all after the truth. The truth was so complex, as Emma has described, and it struck me particularly strongly the analogy with what she was saying about Iraq and Afghanistan. And one really wants to start at the very beginning and say, physician, heal thyself or heal thy soul. Because one of the biggest utopian fantasists making policy over Iraq was one Tony Blair. Tony Blair thought that you could create a model polity. I doubt if he would have called it a Western democracy, but a polity by which you could clean up Middle East politics and you could even solve. I mean, he was in his most grandiose messianic mode at this point, post 2003, and you might even resolve the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. The problem with the reporting on the ground was actually understanding what was going on and how the different groups behaved and what their history was. History, as the famous Oxford exam question says, history teaches you that history teaches you nothing, but it can guide you. It can tell you what the DNA was. And it was very striking in Afghanistan, for example, when there was a very good reason, a casus belli, to go to kick bin Laden and his crew out of Kabul in 2001. But thereafter, the failed attempts at remodeling Afghanistan and Afghanistan's politics without the means or even actually a focused aim was quite extraordinary. When there were people, not from my discipline, not from the field historians, but there were anthropologists, and I can name a handful for you, who actually knew the way the dynamics of the different groups would play and what would happen. The problem is, it's not, no, I don't criticize the reporters on the ground. I have huge admiration, and particularly, you know, to name people like Anthony Lloyd, at least who sat at the BBC, Quentin Somerville, just a name, it's invidious, because there's some really good and brave people and some very intelligent reporting amidst great difficulty from Yemen currently. It is actually, we're giving the reporting from the ground and the kind of work that Emma has done too little space in our consideration. There's too much by the commentariat, and the commentariat is driven very often by the political bubbles at home. Washington, of course, New York, and London, Paris, they're terribly important. And very often, they too easily, could I say, they get into echo chambers about this. And I absolutely agree with Emma. At different times, there were different opportunities where you could have done something different. For NATO to drive a project to put its footprint, in inverted commas, all over Afghanistan after 2004, a project launched in 2005, as we now can see, was absolutely based on so many false assumptions, it was almost bound to end in tears and failure.
I'd now like to leave Iraq and Afghanistan to one side for the moment. Emma, you said that one of the crucial problems here in the Middle East is that these are often rentier states who are reliant upon oil revenues. And in light of that situation, what impact is the coronavirus pandemic having on the region now, from what you've managed to gather? Does a sharp fall in oil prices mean that we're likely to see change to these regimes, or will this just be a crisis for ordinary people?
And the coronavirus is a sort of a threat multiplier on top of all the other issues that are there. When you look at Iraq at the moment, reported deaths are about 2,800. But there's a sense that the pandemic is spreading and you see the government officials wearing masks. But, you know, they're heading towards bankruptcy in Iraq by the end of the year. But the biggest story at the moment is the assassination of Dr. Hashem al-Hashemi, who was an analyst on extremist groups in Iraq and who was very close to the prime minister. He was a brilliant guy and a really respected commentator on Iraqi affairs. And he had basically spoken out. I mean, he'd done a lot of research on ISIS, but also on the Shia militias. And he'd spoken out against the corrupt political class in Iraq and Iranian interference that keeps Iraq in a state of dysfunction. And he paid for that bravery with his life. And so when you look at Iraq, you have the situation where you've got non-state actors, particularly Iranian-backed militias, that keep Iraq in this state of dysfunction. And unless the government cracks down on them, this state of dysfunction will continue. It's very depressing. So COVID is just it comes on top of this, but there are fundamental problems with the way these countries are led and governed.
I think you've really hit on the tragedy of it there, Emma, and because what people my age in the Middle East want, it seems, is not something unreasonable or something hopelessly idealistic. They just want functioning utilities and jobs and opportunities. And Robert, you've written recently about the Caesar Act and the sanctions being brought by the United States against the Assad regime. I wanted to ask you, how effective are sanctions in the region when it comes to dealing with rogue governments? Is there a sense in which they serve to strengthen these regimes in some ways rather than undermining them?
Well, this will hit the named parties. There are named parties in this, but we're just not writing about enough. Insolvency, bankruptcy is a thing that is spreading across the region now because the Assad regime, that's why he had a go at his cousin to try and get his wealth out. The regime in Damascus couldn't pay salaries last month. And on top of that, we have got this now unquantifiable, not drifting, but bereft population of refugees or internally displaced, in other words, as I imply, within countries like Syria and Lebanon. But Lebanon now has, I think, probably a third of its population is now a refugee. And Jordan, although slightly more stable, is in an equally difficult position. Back to COVID, we have no idea, honestly, and I've been phoning into camps and talking to doctor friends, actually the incidence of COVID amongst the refugee population who are in a terrible state. We were talking the other day to Pierre Pedersen, the UN special envoy on Syria, and he reckons the internal population now in Syria, which is amazing considering who has fled and how they've been displaced and so on to the five neighboring countries, it's between 7 and 9 million who are desperately in need of food aid, which means that about 2/3 of those, by his reckoning, are on the point of starvation. Another point very quickly that Emma raised, and quite rightly, it is the battle of the militias. So much kinetic fighting power on the ground has gone away from the state managers, whether it's Tehran, Moscow, Damascus, or even the United States or Britain and France. The roiling of the militias, some tribal, but actually they're based on mercenaries as well, that you're getting in Libya, for example, is that the idea that, you know, Egypt, UAE, Moscow speak on one side and Italy, Turkey, and the United Nations on the others, but they have very, very little effect on the ground. It is a kind of medieval anarchy because although they're arguing about state politics, they have nothing to do with the state themselves.
I'd like to dive slightly deeper into the Syrian crisis now. This still looms large over the region. And Emma, you've previously said that Western interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan really poisoned what was possible in Syria. I was just wondering whether you could expand on what you mean by this.
Well, when you think about Syria, it's almost like the very even idea of an international community was allowed to die. And more than 500,000 Syrians killed, half the population displaced from their homes. All sides have committed atrocities. But the regime was by far the worst offender. It's been complete impunity for torture, bombing of religious sites, the deliberate targeting of hospitals. So total disdain has been shown for international norms. And it's just been a disaster. And there was a quote from a previous Obama official, Phil Gordon, who said, you know, we invaded Iraq, we intervened and occupied, and the result was a disaster. In Libya, we intervened but didn't occupy, and the result was a disaster. In Syria, we didn't intervene and we didn't occupy, and the result is a disaster. And that sense that there is nothing that the West can do, that it's just doomed to fail. And I think when people looked at Syria, they saw Iraq. And, you know, again, at various stages in the Syrian conflict, there were different options. And those, you know, different choices were made. And Syria today, it's a blot on the conscience of the international community. And the thing with what happens in Syria, it affects the West. If everything that happened in the Middle East stayed in the Middle East, you could just say, let them be. But it doesn't stay in the Middle East. You see the refugee outflows, you see terrorism, and it's been a tragedy, it's been a disaster, and it's going to affect us for decades to come.
So picking up on the Syrian situation, this seems to me to play into this kind of cliched but age-old divide between ideals and realism. One of the clear things which came from your book, Emma, and your time in Iraq, was that this kind of naive, crusading idealism, pro-democracy idealism, was very damaging in the end in Iraq. But the sort of callous realism that we've seen employed by Russia and at times US administrations in Syria and elsewhere is also very damaging and harmful to Western interests, ultimately. So what I want to ask you is there a constructive middle way for the Middle East? And what would a better approach from Western governments actually look like?
You know, you can look back and we were so naive that we thought there was only one possible outcome. And that outcome was democracy. We had no imagination that there could be other outcomes. The idea that ISIS and all those things emerged, we had no imagination for that. We live in a different era now, and it really is a different era. The world's transitioning, you know, from a unipolar to a multipolar world, and the Middle East is one of multiple competing spheres of influence. So you see Russia and China coming in, and you see all the regional powers competing. And it's not like, oh, we've learned now from the experiences and we'll do it better next time. We're in a different world. When you look at the state of the US domestically or the state of Britain domestically, you know, democracy doesn't look so good. The model doesn't look so good anymore. And international cooperation isn't working in the way that it was supposed to work. You've only got to look at Libya and think, is that the post-American world where you've got, you know, Turkey and Qatar supporting groups who the UN has said are the legitimate government of Libya, the government of national accord. And then you've got France and Russia and the UAE and Egypt supporting other groups, General Haftar. And you've got Russia and Syria sending mercenaries from Syria to, you know, defend oil inside Libya. And the UN has lost its role of having moral legitimacy or relevance. And France and Russia are supposed to be members of the UN Security Council, but they were supporting people against the UN-backed government. And, you know, there's no joint policy from the European Union. You know, when you look at the region, the Arab states are in crisis. There's deep pathologies there. And the hopes of the Arab Spring, that these uprisings would push these states to reform, it didn't work out that way. The regime has proved incapable of reform. They either countered or they collapsed. And so these Arab states, they've got demographic pressures. There's climate change. They can no longer provide security for their people or employment or basic services. The social contract between the rulers and the ruled is frayed. You know, this is not going to suddenly be resolved. This is going to be a long, long, long process. It's not going to suddenly be the end and a happy ending.
Robert, do you have anything to add on that?
Well, I could actually have a whole discussion with Emma about that, because I think she has depicted exactly the semblance that you've got. And Syria is a perfect example of this. It looks like a wicked problem. It looks like a problem without a solution. But I think that if you start looking at the heart of the paradox, you might begin to find a way through. And the paradox is this, that you can only get settlement in Syria, as Pedersen and others and Stefan de Mistura have said, if you get agreement and settlement from the indigenous peoples. And yet they need help from outside. But there is no single outside power or grouping of outside powers that can bring salvation or solution to Syria. And this is where it's very interesting to see the approach. I mean, I agree with Emma, the international mosaic surrounding Libya is absolutely eye-watering. I'm sorry, she should have thrown in the Sudanese and the sub-Saharan mercenaries that are being brought in to occupy oil fields on behalf of the Russian mercenaries. I mean, it is so absolutely bizarre. But again, this sort of great team who I do think we underestimate, by golly, they had the patience of Job. People like Pedersen, the Norwegian, who's still there, his predecessor, Staffan de Mistura, a great friend, and Salamé, the Lebanese, in Libya. But it was Salamé who put it to me the other day. He said the one of the real tragedies, and it applies in Syria, but particularly over Libya, is actually what the individual international powers want is so minimalist. He said, in negotiating, he said, if you talk to the Americans, all they were worried about was the war against terrorism, Daesh and ISIS and what they were going to do. If you talk to the EU and the Europeans, all they talked about was migrants. Somehow, we've got to talk about building a polity. And I agree with Emma, the idea that you build some outdated Westminster model democracy, constitutional cat's cradle on that sort of basis is absolute nonsense. But this is the thing where you have to get down to discuss. But this is where I think that the patrons have got to get a lot tougher with their protégés. One of the things that's absolutely clear, for instance, as far as Bashar al-Assad is concerned, and I had a briefing from Zarif, the extremely smooth foreign minister of Iran, only this week, and have heard on the other side from Russian representatives, he has run out of road. They know this is going nowhere. And for both Iran and for Russia, keeping Assad going beyond next year, say, I don't think they're going to pull the plug tomorrow, is absolutely a losing game to them. And once you begin to get that, you've got to get a coalition of interests. Russia set up its own forum to bring peace to or to manage Syria through the Astana process. And that has brought Turkey, Russia and Iran together. But at last, they're beginning to say, actually, we'd better do a deal with the UN process in Geneva. It takes too long because, as Emma said, there are millions of people now on the point of death. The level of atrocities in Libya has taken everybody by surprise as they got into Sirte and places like that. And we know people are dying in and around the camps and in this completely uprooted population inside Libya itself. But it is a failure of international institutions. But you don't do a Trump on it and pull the plug on them, as he's done with the WHO and almost with everything else. It's got to come with what we've got. What we've got, we've got to try and make work better. What is very difficult with these very narcissistic regimes like Trump and Boris Johnson in England, it is very difficult to prove to them actually it is also in their own interest to help out there. Because that's why you get the England first, the America first, the Russia first. It's the enemy of cooperation.
So one of the things that you've both said today is that we're always drawing the wrong lessons from the Middle East. I've got a slightly rogue suggestion to make. And is it the case that we also draw the wrong parallels? We spoke a bit about the Arab Spring. And was there a sense that too many policymakers were trapped in this post-Cold War mindset where they thought that the Arab Springs would be like the Eastern European revolutions from 1989 and onwards? Would a more helpful comparison have been with the frustrations of reformism in Iran and the failure of the Green Movement? Would that be a better basis for policymakers to understand these things? Or would that also be oversimplification of another kind?
You know, I think with all the analogies that were initially taken, that there was just that naive optimism that basically the world is moving towards liberal democracy. We had this from Fukuyama at the end of the Cold War. It was the only pathway to modernity that people could imagine. That America was at the top and all the other countries were trying to get up the ladder to become like America. And I think that has been the main problem, was only able to see an optimistic outcome. And the failure to imagine that these could go really, really wrong. I mean, now when you look back at our approach in 2003, it seems a little bit crazy. You can't imagine that people could be so hubristic, so naive. But at the time, that was very much the spirit. We rebuilt Germany and Japan after World War II. We're going to do it here. There was no sense that this could go wrong. We did it in the Balkans. We're going to do it again in Iraq. That ungoverned spaces breed terrorism, that promoting democracy is not just the right thing to do, it's a national security imperative to change those regimes, because those sorts of autocratic regimes, they foster grievance, which leads to terrorism. So you had this whole freedom agenda without any sense that, gosh, this sounds a little bit overambitious and a little bit crazy. And how about the local people in those countries? We treated them as if they were the passive recipients of our benevolence, which of course they weren't. They had their dreams and their aspirations. I think more than anything, we lacked imagination about how badly things could go wrong. And today people are not looking towards the US or the UK as the model of governance. People might refer to Dubai as, you know, that seems to function well. People can work there. They can pursue their dreams there. It's a functioning state. And so for prosperity, they're quite willing to sacrifice political freedoms, because security and prosperity, after everything that people have seen in the region, that looks good enough. So you hear young people say, we want to live in Dubai, not under Daesh.
Robert, do you have anything to add there?
I agree. And I think, again, it's the performance of Narcissus. Think of how many of these policies, not doing it, but the way this coalition went into Afghanistan and into Iraq, a lot of the seeds of that were done in really peculiar think tanks across the West. And where Emma is actually so right is there is an element of self-deception. And I don't want to sound like a terrible Luddite, but the thing that does encourage this kind of closed circuit kind of thinking, the echo chamber so-called, has been social media. The thing that I noticed, you know, in my lifetime of reporting, which is coming up to 53 years, but the fact is that, you know, when you went constantly on the mobile phone to headquarters in Broadcasting House or the New York Times or whatever, you are actually slogging through the sand or the dirt, talking often with an interpreter, but to the communities you were among. And you didn't have this preset view, which is so extraordinary. And I was just struck me, and it struck me powerfully on and off ever since, that when we got the way Tahrir Square in Cairo and the Arab Spring in Egypt was portrayed, of course, it came with Obamaism. We got the Cairo speech we needed Voltaire around. All is for the best and the best of all possible worlds. And I think, with a compliment, a bouquet to my interlocutor, Emma, what we have not done, and we should learn for COVID, with all these examples of plague literature from the Black Death to Boccaccio and to Albert Camus, is that we need the kinds of Albert Camus of our day, the littérateur engagé. Camus was a combat thinker. He worked with a combat paper under resistance. And this is the point. It's the trouble is that the way we're communicating with ourselves at the moment is that we're looking at ourselves in the mirror and we're doing too much based on think tanks. What is really going on in the ground is so fascinating. And I just wake up every morning and wonder about a whole load of things I really would like to know. For example, COVID-19 in Cairo. This is the thing that's really scaring the Sisi regime to death, because the people who are doing social, basic sanitary care are the mosques again. Woohoo! This means a resurgence of the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood, according to the elite in Cairo, and I know quite a few, are at all hands. You know, that they're all over London. They're absolutely stirring up trouble in Libya. They're stirring up trouble in Syria. You know, and you cannot trust the Qataris, because Qatar is A, the well of iniquity for sponsoring the Muslim Brotherhood. And of course, they're secretly in bed with Iran. And so it goes on and so it goes on. But I do think that the thing that upsets me thinking about it, you know, the kind of people that Emma and I came across, great thinkers, Middle East thinkers, and that's what's so awful about Hisham al-Hashimi's assassination. There are people around that can do it and can do the thinking. But, you know, that you get the proconsular class, you know, that I was an ambassador a million years ago in Tehran and so on. Yeah, but what's changed? The caravan of history moves on all the time. You know, that let's see what's coming up this time. And we do have to understand more and more about the DNA of society, human geography, humans in a very, very rapidly changing, human-made, artificial and unnatural landscape.
Finally, Emma, to wrap up, is there some hope for the Middle East after the coronavirus crisis?
You have to look for hope, and I think you find hope in the young generation. There are some amazing young people in the region who really have been through a lot, who are educated and who want a better future. And I think that is where we find hope, because their understanding of their situation, their rejection of sectarianism, their yearning for, you know, just to be treated with dignity, to have opportunities to develop themselves, it's in the youth. It's with them that hope lies. You have to think of how can we give this young generation opportunities, opportunities to study in the West, opportunities for exchanges, opportunities to create a better Middle East.
On that note, Emma and Robert, thank you very much. That's all we have time for today. Next episode, I'll be joined by Matthew Goodwin, who will be talking about populism. Thank you.